This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Yehi Swohib. Coming up on Africa News Tonight,
the entire internet has been shut down. We are currently in the dark right now. There's no way of telling what's happening unless if you make a call or a text. We are currently in the dark now.
That's reporter Kudzai Zinawashi in Harare. We'll have the latest from Zimbabwe coming up.
Also in Nairobi, an explosion rocks an upscale hotel today. And in the DRC, the Martin Falulu's claim that he was robbed of victory.
We'll have these stories and lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight.
Hello. Yes.
The Kenyan capital has been hit by another terror attack as an explosion rocks the upscale Dusit Hotel today, followed by heavy exchanges of gunfire. No figures were immediately available on casualties, although witnesses reported seeing at least two bodies and said at least two dozen people were injured. The Somali-based Al-Shabaab extremist group claims responsibility for the attack. It occurred a day after a Kenyan court ruled that three men must stand trial for their alleged role in the 2013 terrorist attack on Nairobi's Westgate Mall by Al-Shabaab. And now live with us is Mohammed Yusuf from Nairobi. Hello, Mohammed.
Hello, Kim.
Yes, thank you for joining us. Can you tell us what is the situation right now on the ground?
The situation on the ground right now is that the operation is still ongoing so far. Yes, so some people being rescued. About an hour ago, Kenyan police chief addressed the media, saying, confirmed there was an attack, but he didn't describe whether it was a terror attack. But again, he's saying basically security officers are still doing the operation, and the criminals are holed up in the complex area where we have an hotel and a couple of offices blocks in central Nairobi.
Can you tell us exactly what happened and how this explosion occurred?
From the first images that emerged from the area, where it seems that the attackers first attacked a restaurant just not far from the entrance, and followed by gunfire. But so far, Al-Shabaab has said that we did carry out the attack. And they went ahead by saying that we began the attack with an explosion followed by gunfire. But the Kenyan police are yet to give much information or much details of how the attack happened. There's no much information at the moment as we speak.
Now, I understand two bodies have been recovered and maybe two dozen people were injured. So were these the two people that were killed, were they hotel guests?
It's not yet clear the two people who are reported dead. Of course, we've seen several people injured coming out of the building with blood stains, and some of them, their clothes charred. So, but again, the information we're getting is really not clear at the moment. The two people who are dead, whether they're the terrorists or the civilians or the shop people who are in that building. But as we know so far, it's going to be a long night. The criminals, as the police call them at the moment, still hold up, and the security are engaging them in that area.
Al-Shabaab is said to be claiming responsibility for this attack, and does it have to do with the three men who are going to be standing trial for their role in the Westgate Mall attack?
There's a bit of a link there. The court ruling on Monday that three people should stand trial when they're released. But also remember today commemorates 3 years since Kenyan military forces were attacked in a base in Somalia by Al-Shabaab. So these two events are kind of linked together. But so far, Al-Shabaab has been carrying out this campaign against Kenyan security forces and civilian installations, like one witnessed today. 5 years ago, there was a Westgate shopping mall attack. And the first in 5 years we're seeing now, they've carried attack in Nairobi, but there have been several attacks in the last couple of months, weeks, and years in the Kenyan coast. And in the northeastern region that shares Kenya-Somalia border. But so far, find out. There doesn't been know much about an attack.
What is the Kenyan government saying at this time about this attack?
So far, they haven't given much detail of the men. For example, the number, we know there's several men. But again, this is the kind of a situation we witnessed 5 years ago in West, a small attack, where there have been a couple of men, but no one knows really what happened to them. And again, is this going to be similar to that situation? But again, the terms have been really clear this time around compared to 5 years ago, that this time around there seems to be massive coordination within the security sector. And that may have helped situation, because we've seen hundreds and hundreds of civilians coming out of that building. And that shows you that in terms of coordination, it works well compared to what happened 5 years ago. There's a bit of an improvement in that area, but again, there's always that for people up for some time, and we'll see what this Al-Shabaab can do when we give them a space to operate as one soon today.
Okay, thank you so much, Mohammed. Appreciate your time and for giving us this insight into this attack that occurred at a Kenyan hotel in Nairobi today.
Simu Warunga is a retired captain in the Kenya Defense Force who now runs the African Center for Security and Strategic Studies, a security consulting company in Nairobi. Just a few moments ago, he spoke with our colleague Kate Pound-Dawson about today's attack at the Dusty D2 Hotel and the office complex in Nairobi.
Hello. Yes, Harold.
Describe to me exactly what happened. What you saw?
The former president of the Somali Olympic Committee as well, Committee Duran Farah, was in the hotel compound when the attack happened. He was with a Somali delegation meeting with an aid agency. He spoke with Harun Maruf of the VOA Somali service and described the attack.
Hello. Yes, Harun.
Describe to me exactly what happened. What you saw?
Thank you very much. I think what we thought we went through a checkpoint in a hotel called Dusit D2 in Nairobi. We are in a meeting with an organization who was actually based next to the hotel. And by the time we backed the place and we wanted to enter the office, we wanted to go, a lot of explosion happened on the gate.
What happened next?
Next, there was a shooting, exchange of fire, a lot of fire. And we've seen people rushing and running around very badly. People are running in every direction.
So there was shooting, and then what did you do next?
And before we entered the offices, we looked outside and we've seen people running from every direction.
And then
we came down and we ran with the people, and actually there was an alleyway behind the building, and we went through that one, that building.
So
and after about nearly 500 yards, there was a main road. We crossed the main road, and we were still hearing the gunshot.
So where did the explosion take place?
The explosion took place at the gate of the entry of the hotel and the compound. The hotel is in a compound. It's in a big compound.
Was it a car?
It was a hotel and also offices.
Was it a car explosion or suicide bombers?
We believe that it was a car explosion. Although we were not there at the time, but the sign is it was an explosion. And then I think some militias with guns came in.
Did you see anybody? Did you see anyone injured or killed?
Yeah, we've seen many people injured who've been taken out from the building. And I think what we're hearing, they are still in the compound. The attackers are still in the compound.
So describe to me the atmosphere, the situation at the time of the explosion.
The atmosphere, it was a very scary one. Actually, you can understand people who came from Norland for daily life to their offices and their place of work. And these sort of things happen. An explosion, a huge explosion, which is actually very frightening. And also, you see people with guns and shooting from every direction. So the people have to run away for their lives. Wherever they see, they feel it, they can run to.
So
luckily, we were one of those people who came out safe. And we are hopefully all our prayers are with those who are inside, and hopefully we hope they will come out safely.
What time did the explosion occur?
It was exactly 3:30 p.m. in East African time.
That was Duran Farah, former president of the Somali Olympic Committee, speaking with VOA's Harun Maruf.
Zimbabwe's government has shut down internet access as violent protests continue to spread across the country. Many users are unable to access Facebook and the popular Facebook-owned instant messaging platform WhatsApp. Twitter and Instagram have reportedly also been affected. The protest erupted after President Emmerson Mnangagwa's announcement of a 150% rise in fuel prices last Saturday. Mnangagwa defended the decision yesterday at the start of a five-nation tour. He told reporters in Moscow that, quote, Zimbabwe is going through both political and economic reforms, and these do not come easily. It will take time for things to settle and results to be shown, unquote. He said the fuel price hike was necessary because local fuel was the cheapest in the region. Reporter Kudzai Zvinovashi is in Harare and spoke with me today about the internet shutdown.
The entire internet has been shut down. We are currently in the dark right now. There's no way of telling what's happening unless if you make a call or a text. We are currently in the dark now.
And what is happening on the ground right now with this internet shutdown?
Well, the internet shutdown is coming after the first day of a three-day shutdown, which was called by the Zimbabwe Congress of Trade Unions, ZCTU. So this is mainly coming from the president's announcement that fuel prices will be going up starting midnight of Saturday last weekend. So people are protesting against that and the general high cost of living we have experienced in the past weeks. These are some of the issues that have inspired this shutdown, considering the violence that characterized the first day of the stay away yesterday.
Now, there were several people killed yesterday when police in Harare and Bulawayo, they fired live ammunition at protesters. Is that correct?
It is correct. There are a lot of cases of gunshot wounds. I was on the phone with Zimbabwe Association for Doctors for Human Rights, and they are saying by end of day yesterday they had recorded 26 cases of wounded people wounded from gunshots. While the number of how many people have died isn't exactly available at the present moment, some have been confirmed dead.
And what are people doing now to try to actually just make a living since they're not able to get to work?
The people are stuck in between a rock and a hard surface right now. You can't go to work because yesterday there were also reports of protesters who were harassing those people who were going to work, saying, we said we are staying away. Why are you going to work? So a colleague of mine was covering in Kwazana, one of the hotspots where there was a lot of violence and barricaded roads. He had to pay for passage at every barricade that he went through, and he was threatened with violence. So there's no going around this one. We will have to stick it out, wait for 3 days and see where it goes. But the way the government is dealing with this by shutting down the internet, they have made sure that the shutdown cannot be prolonged in any way because people have no means of communicating. So that means after 3 days, people will just have to assume that the stay away is now over and they'll go back to work. But if they turn on the internet, we may see another case where there is a follow-up action to say, let's do another shutdown in the coming week or let's do a protest or something like that along those lines until government maybe hits to the call to reduce the fuel prices and the high cost of living.
That was reporter Kudzai Zvinovashi speaking with me from Harare.
19 past the hour, you're listening to African News Tonight on The Voice of America. The International Criminal Court acquitted former Ivory Coast President Laurent Gbagbo today and ordered his immediate release, ruling that the prosecution failed to prove its case. The 73-year-old Gbagbo had been detained 7 years on charges of crimes against humanity. He refused to step down after losing the 2010 election, setting off clashes that killed 2,000 people. His former youth minister also was acquitted. Supporters in the courtroom and in Gbagbo's hometown were jubilant, and his political party called the development a big step towards reconciliation in the country. Gbagbo's release was delayed till Wednesday, and prosecutors have said they will appeal. The ICC has run into challenges in its attempts to try top politicians, including two other African presidents, for crimes committed by subordinates or followers.
The DRC's post-election chaos moved to the judicial system today as the Constitutional Court began hearing opposition candidate Martin Fayulu's claim that he was robbed of victory. The 16-nation Southern African Development Community is expected to hold an emergency meeting Thursday in Addis Ababa to discuss the situation. The DRC's Election Commission says official results show opposition candidate Felix Tshisekedi won about 39% of the December 30th ballot to 35% for Fayulu. But Fayulu claims he got 61%. The influential Roman Catholic Church also has disputed the official count, although it hasn't said who it thinks won. The Financial Times has conducted its own count that it says is in line with Fayulu's tally. Several of the nine judges are allies of current President Joseph Kabila. Even if it were to rule against the official count, an annulment of the vote would keep Kabila in power until a new vote could be arranged.
Well, what I think was responsible was that
as Nigerians prepare to cast their ballots in the presidential and national assembly elections, there are concerns about the impact of voter apathy. The elections are February 16th, followed by governor and state assembly elections on March 2nd. Nigeria's election body, the Independent National Electoral Commission, says of the 43.65% turnout in 2015, the country's southeast zone was among the places with particularly low turnout. Olo Omotayo is the president of Civil Rights Realization and Advancement Network, a non-governmental organization. He spoke to reporter Mike Mbonye about voter apathy and implications on the upcoming elections. He says some voters did not cast ballots because successive governments failed to keep election promises.
Well, what I think was responsible was that the people here are conscious of their business. And the fact that since the advent of this democracy, the masses believe that there have not been much economic gains. So people find it difficult to abandon their work and going about issue of voting or politics. So it's just the performance of successive governments in this zone. That's what I think is responsible.
Is it equally bad in the rest of the country, this voter apathy?
Well, it's bad because when just maybe 30% of the population that are entitled to vote voted, doesn't give a good reflection of the outcome of an election.
Do you think the trend will change in the 2019 elections?
It may change slightly because of the massive campaign, the enlightenment by political parties and INEC. Actually, there is not going to be a massive or dramatic turn from what happened in 2019. Just a slight change from what happened in 2015.
Why do you say so, sir?
Because when you look the feelings of the people, when you move with the people, people still believe that there have not been much improvement in the economy, that it has not actually affected the poor masses on the streets. So they felt that it's just like wasting of time for them to abandon their work and be going about their politics.
Are relevant agencies doing enough to make the people vote on election day?
What I see there is that INEC is actually doing its best campaigning, enlightening the people on the need for them to vote. But the thing still boils down to the parties in government. Once the party performs very well, it will encourage the people. But you see a lot of our people are in abject poverty. So that's the main reason why they don't actually focus or even have interest in this election. So it's the government that needs, successive government has to improve on their performance so that people will actually have, they will actually gain what we can say dividend of democracy. It will actually reflect in their lives. So that one will encourage them to participate more in this election and democracy.
Some political analysts say the inability of the parties to sell good ideas to the people can be a reason for voter apathy. What's your take on this?
It's not actually good idea that not selling good ideas. They have always been campaigning, giving people their manifesto and what they plan to do to them. But when you look at since 1999, when you look at it, just few governors that have actually performed at least above average in this zone. So that's why people feel that they have been hearing all this campaign. What they need is performance, what will reflect on their lives and the lives of their children. So that's what is actually happening in this zone. The people, they felt that they have not actually gained what they're supposed to gain in a democracy.
That was Olu Omotayo, president of Civil Rights Realization and Advancement Network, speaking with reporter Mike Mbonye in Enugu, Nigeria.
Parents of students at an all-girl American academy in Liberia are anxiously awaiting an investigation into allegations that the charity failed to act on signs of a staff member's sexual abuse. A 2018 expose published by the U.S.-based research organization ProPublica and Time magazine on the More Than Me Academy sparked public outrage over the widespread rape and exploitation of girls who were supposed to be rescued. But some of the parents are frustrated with how the story has been told and reject calls for the academy to close its doors. Monique John reports from Monrovia.
Some of the parents sitting before me in a small dark alley in their West Point community, Liberia's largest slum, have been sending their girls to the More Than Me Academy since the charity opened in 2013. But their allegiance is being tested. The academy, which aims to protect girls by getting them off the street, is being investigated over a rape scandal.
But what I go on is the feeling bad.
Somo M. Golafa, a parent of two More Than Me students, says her daughters are saddened by the news. They constantly hear about their school's sex abuse case on the radio. The expose in ProPublica and Time magazine accuses the school of failing to act as Macintosh Johnson, a Liberian co-founder, raped girls as young as 11 years old, infecting at least three of them with HIV, the virus that causes AIDS. Johnson was arrested in 2014 when the rapes were first reported. The case ended in a mistrial, and Johnson died in custody. Critics blame American founder Katie Miller and other staff for ignoring signs of abuse. Caroline Boa Brown is a prominent activist in Liberia. A member of the Liberia Feminist Forum, she is a leading organizer in the We Are Unprotected campaign that protests the molestation and oversights at the academy. Flanked by her fellow protesters in their signature all-black attire, Brown denounces the school for its lack of preparation and safeguarding.
They did not have adequate measures in place. They did not have adequate procedures in place to be able to deal with these issues. We are talking since 2014. There's been severe negligence on the part of the management of More Than Me, and Katie Miller is responsible.
Miller stepped down from the board of the charity, which critics want closed. They say it was never qualified to work with Liberia's vulnerable girls and blame the government for allowing it to operate. However, Solomon Denyu, a longtime parent at More Than Me and the school's PTA chairman, says Mailer isn't the only one at fault.
This thing should not be blamed on Katie alone. Though Katie had a part in it, but we the parents and the governor of Liberia, we have the giant share of it.
Denyu says that parents should have been more careful in protecting their children. He says they let Johnson have too much unsupervised access to students. He also condemns the government for not being more vigilant and responsive at the onset of the case. And while parents anxiously await the investigation results, some argue the academy still has value. They want the school to stay open and to continue receiving support. Angeline Yenu, another MTM parent, is begging donors to not turn their backs on the children.
Because if their school breaks down tomorrow, the children will take the street back. They were staying to the same sex for money what they were doing before Katie went and took them from there.
It's not yet clear when the Liberian government will finish the investigation of the More Than Me Academy. Parents have welcomed the inquiry, but are upset it took 4 years, and they don't like the attention. Their children are teased because they attend the academy, which, despite the ongoing investigation, still assists in running 18 schools in Liberia. Monique John for VOA News, Monrovia.
And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehei Suhibi in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis, and thanks for choosing the VOA.
Hey, sports fans, brighten your day by tuning in to the Sunny Side of Sports, Monday through Friday at 1630 and 1830 UTC. Join us on Facebook at facebook.com/VOA Sunny and on Twitter at VOA Sunny Sports. Or check out the blog at blogs.voanews.com/Sunny. It's the Sunny Side of Sports right here on the Voice of America.